We will hear argument now on Four Star Enterprises et al. Versus Employers Mutual.
All right. May it please the court.
Mr. Marsh.
I think I'm considered the appellant on this, so I typically, at these hearings, don't have too much to say. I'm more here to ask or answer questions if you have any questions. I think long and short of it is we've got a judgment here. Judge Brown entered a judgment in favor of Four Star. It's our opinion that, in fact, he found that EMC, or Employers Mutual, was coextensively liable under that judgment. However, he failed to impose coextensive judgment or coextensive liability for the interest, for all the interest on that judgment.
Mr. Marsh, tell me how Four Star has standing here when in August of 1999 they ceased to exist and signed everything out?
Well, I don't know that they ceased to exist, but nonetheless, under Rule 5213C, they were allowed to proceed, and they did. So they have standing to take the judgment in their name, which they did.
How does the assignment of that claim to RGH factor into that analysis?
RGH is actually the person behind, the entity behind the scenes that owns the claim.
Right.
But it's in the name of Four Star, which is allowed under the rules and under the statute.
Okay. And that statute and those rules are in your brief, sir?
I don't think I included the statute, but the rule is 5213C.
Right.
And there's a corresponding statute, but I couldn't tell you what it is right now.
Oh, well, that's fine then. But it's something that's related to 5213C.
Yeah. The rule. I mean, I think it tracks the language almost exactly.
Okay.
So point one of our brief indicated or argued that the case of Howard, I think it's Teddy Woods versus Howard, should have been followed. And it's our contention here today that that lays out a framework, a roadmap, of how the interest should have been assessed. Although the time frame in Teddy Woods was a lot closer, a lot more compact than what we have in this Four Star case, obviously, the sequence of events is virtually the same. I mean, there was a default judgment in that case, and the court allowed interest on that default judgment. And then when they entered judgment against the surety, I think it's Intigon, they allowed interest on the entire default judgment. So that's all we're seeking here under count one. Count two, or point two, is more of a technical issue. We did point out to the judge, Judge Brown, that at least it was our contention that the total amount of the four-star judgment as of the date he entered his judgment was $176,000-some, I think it is. It's in the brief, and so that's what we contend, that if this judgment is proper in the first place, that's the amount it should have been entered for in favor of Four Star against EMC. I would like to, I don't know if the court wants to entertain anything about the motion to examine jurisdiction.
We are aware of that, and we know that, and it's being taken with the case, so we will address that, and I don't think you guys have put everything in the motion and responses, so we'll take that.
Right.
I can tell you that we are leaning away from finding that there's no jurisdiction, so proceed with that premise in mind.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's fine. And the ED case that I cited in my motion is one that I kind of stumbled across as we were preparing the brief on these cases. So that's kind of what spurred that along. So,
we'll give it a careful look.
Yeah, the facts of that case are very similar to what we have here.
All right.
So the standing issue, I don't think there's any problem with that. I mean, I don't see any problem with that, and I hope the court doesn't. Four Star was perfectly entitled to pursue this the way they did. Once they got the default judgment against TNT, whether they were entitled to pursue the bond claim against EMC. The prior court opinion of this court pretty well lays out how that works in footnote 7 So I don't know that I can say it any better than footnote 7 of the original four-star case said. So with that, I'm going to sit down and listen to some questions.
I'm going to ask you a quick question. Your third point deals with a statute of limitations issue.
Right.
What do you think is the correct statute that should have been applied here?
Well, there's only one statute that could apply here, and it's the 10-year statute.
10-year on written?
Right, written document, written agreement to pay money.
Agreement. Okay.
And on that issue, the reason RGH is really even involved in this case in the first place is when we filed our proof of claim back in 2006 or whatever it was against EMC or to EMC, we included a copy of the TNT judgment. We also included the proof of claim form, and we made a note on there, I think. It's in the pleadings. But we made a note on that form that the claim, I think, had been assigned to RGH. Well, they got back, and the respondent says, well, no, we're not going to pay the claim because it's been assigned to RGH. So that's why we did an amended claim at that time, proof of claim, and included RGH in the lawsuit. So, like I say, technically, RGH is the power behind the throne of the four-star judgment, but as far as I know, the four-star judgment's good.
And the trial court applied a different statute, the five-year statute. Is that the one dealing with things like tort claims and other
right.
kind of uncategorized claims?
Right. Yeah, I know I responded in my brief to this statute of limitations argument. Jonathan indicated in his brief that the minor case had been expressly overruled by the Griffiths case, I think it is.
Right.
I don't think that is the case. Obviously, the Persons versus Griffin or Griffiths versus Persons case, that involved penalties for prevailing wage, unpaid prevailing wages. There's a specific statute of limitations for that type of claim. It was 3 years, so they properly applied the penalty statute of limitations to the penalty claim.
Okay.
Here, we don't have that. We've got the general 10-year. With that being said, I'll sit down and shut up.
Thank you.
May I remove my face mask?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Thank you. A little hot in there. May it please the court, I'm Jonathan Sternberg, and I represent the respondent and cross-appellant, EMC, Employers Mutual Casualty. I want to briefly summarize our case, sort of how Mr. Marsh just did. The trial court correctly granted Surety EMC judgment on assignee RGH's claims because they were time-barred. But it erred in denying EMC summary judgment on Four Star's claims because Four Star lacked standing to sue EMC in 2006 after it did stop existing in 1999 and assigned all its claims to RGH that same year. Alternatively, if either plaintiff could sue EMC in 2006, then the most the trial court could have granted them, if they were to prevail in summary judgment, would have been $18,873 of principal in Four Star's 2005 judgment against alleged subcontractor TNT, because EMC's bond didn't agree to pay interest a subcontractor owed a supplier. And alternatively still, if either plaintiff could sue and EMC could be liable for interest TNT owed, then at the very least there's a genuine dispute of material fact that precludes summary judgment for either plaintiff, because viewing the record most favorably to EMC, the debt they seek to hold EMC to is fraudulent. I want to address each of these points. Let's start with the statute of limitations, which the court just asked Mr. Morris about. The trial court was correct that RGH's claims were time-barred. Four Star admits it assigned the claims against EMC to RGH in 1999. It admits RGH wasn't a party to the prior action against the alleged subcontractor, the principal D&E, and the surety EMC. Instead, they admit that RGH first brought their claims against EMC in 2006. Well, in the Griffin case, which he just mentioned, this court, it wasn't as narrow a decision as Mr. Marsh wants it to be. What the court held was that the statute of limitations for a claim against a surety for a principal's liability, is the same as the underlying action against the principal. There, as he pointed out, it held the 3-year period in 516-400 applied to an action against a payment bond surety for a principal's unpaid wages, despite the plaintiff, just like he's arguing here, arguing that what it was really doing was suing on the bond. This court rejected that, and it rejected that because the statutes had changed since the 1902 case he cites, which the court did acknowledge had been superseded by existing surety statutes. In 1902, when the Minor case was, there was no statute like a payment bond statute like we have today. There was no 107-170 subsection 2. And in Griffin, what the court said is, well, what 107-172, the payment bond statute, does is it doesn't create a cause of action, and it doesn't state its own statute of limitations. What it does is it imports someone else's liability to a surety. And because of that, the liability that you seek to hold the other party to, in that case, the principal for unpaid wages, applies against the surety as well. Kind of like his client tried to do, they named us in the original lawsuit. I mean, that was entirely proper. You often see that, where the plaintiff sues the principal, the subcontractor, and the surety. He did that. But the point is that the underlying claim statute of limitations there, 516-400, applies against the surety as well. Here, he's wrong that 516.110, which is the 10-year statute, applies. It is 516.120. And Judge Bates, you characterize that as tort claims and other stuff.
Well, it's a mix of other things in there.
It is a mix of other things, but one thing that it expressly includes as well is all actions upon contracts except those mentioned in 516.110. And in the E.J. Vitello case in 1997, this court held that the limit, and that's in our brief, all the cases I'll mention are in our brief, this court held the limitation period for an unsigned contract, an action on an unsigned contract, falls under 516.120. All the contracts at issue here that he wants to hold my client to, that is the supplier's contracts, Four Star's contracts with this alleged subcontractor, TNT, they're all unsigned, every last one. He claims in his reply brief that some contracts have scribbled signatures and preclude applying the five-year statute because, viewing the evidence favorably to him, it would be they would be signed contracts. The problem, and Judge Brown saw this, is that those are documents he presented for the first time in the summary judgment proceedings and had no foundation. There's no affidavit or something else attached to those. It's just naked exhibits, 28. We cite them in our brief. We objected to that, and the trial court properly ignored them. Of course, the court has to affirm summary judgment if it's subject to any reasonable theory under the record. That certainly is a reasonable theory. And in the rest of the record, it's undisputed that the contracts between Four Star and TNT are unsigned. So, per Griffin, which I'll note the Supreme Court also approved of Griffin, the party had gotten transfer in Griffin on the basis that, well, all actions against sureties should be subject to the 10-year statute of limitations because we're suing on the bond. After briefing and oral argument in the Supreme Court retransferred the case back here for entry of the original opinion. So it's almost as if it's a Supreme Court decision. As an assignee, RGH takes its claim subject to the same limitations period as the assignor. And that's the Hunt case from 1943 we cite in our brief. We also cite other states in the CJS provision. So those 5 years began at the very latest in 1997 when Four Star sued the alleged subcontractor EMC and D&E. Obviously, at that point, they're ascertainable, so we'll give them that. And EMC, and so meaning Four Star, and therefore its assignee, only had until 2002, 5 years from then, in which to bring its claims against us. It sued us in 2006 for the first time, which he admits that's 4 years too late. The trial court got it right. What the trial court was wrong to do, though, was to hold Four Star had standing to sue EMC in 2006 because it had stopped existing in 99 and assigned its claim to RGH that year. He cited Rule 5213C. I appreciate that Rule 5213C and the merger survival statute, you know, what claims survive a merger, that's 351-450 subsection 5, allowed Four Star to continue its then-pending case, the case it had filed in 1997, against TNT, D&E, EMC, etc., despite the merger and the assignment. We cite the Jordan case from 1983, which holds that a defunct corporation, they're a forfeited corporation, could even continue such an action. We also cite the Cox case from this court in 2011, holding the same thing for an assignor. But Four Star dismissed that action in 2005. At that point, 5213C doesn't apply anymore. At that point, the party has no ongoing claim, nor does the merger survival statute apply. But the trial court here held that the savings statute, 516.230, which gives you a year after a claim is dismissed to file a new action, and it uses the term a new action, and I think that's key, meant Four Star could then, could, despite that dismissal, despite the fact it doesn't exist, could refile that action against EMC. Your Honors, that's simply just not true. The Jordan case in 1983 held that a non-existent corporation cannot take advantage of a savings statute after it had dismissed its claims in a case during which it stopped existing. And again, I appreciate that's a forfeiture. That was where the corporation's charter was forfeited. The Secretary of State dissolved the corporation. This isn't any different, though. The Merger Survival Statute, 351-455, says that it gets to prosecute to judgment. We have cases from the Missouri adopted that statute from Delaware. And there's a Delaware case we cite that holds that once the corporation stops existing, it can't file a new action. Now, the other thing is the savings statute itself, its plain language, answers this question. The savings statute says to file, quote, a new action under its shield from a statute of limitations. That's all it is. It doesn't continue a prior action. It just says you know, the statute of limitations won't bar you. If the party's cause of action survives or descends to another, that party can commence a new action within the one-year time frame. And that's what happened in Jordan. In Jordan, the court held that when the corporation went defunct, when it forfeited its charter, thereafter, its successors, its statutory trustees in that case, could have filed the new action. Here, if we're talking about the merger, U.S. Rentals, which was a Delaware company into which Four Star merged, certainly could have sued because the claim at that point belonged to U.S. Rentals. So with RGH time barred and Four Star lacking standing, and I'll note, he doesn't have any argument at all about the assignment. We have loads of cases in our brief holding that, ignoring the merger for a moment, and Judge Brown ignored this, unfortunately, in his judgment, the assignment alone means Four Star can't sue, even if even if it had never merged into another company at all. The assignor has no cause of action. It's not the real party in interest, and it lacks standing. There's a case, Jacobs versus Fromm, that we cite to that end, and a couple of others, including a 1972 Eastern District on Bank case. So with RGH time barred, Four Star lacking standing, EMC was entitled to judgment as a matter of law on all claims. And that was the error here. What Judge Brown got right was the statute of limitations. What he got wrong was holding that Four Star could sue at all. But I'll go on, since I do have 5 minutes left. If RGH somehow wasn't time barred, and Four Star somehow had standing, then under the undisputed facts, the trial court couldn't charge us for interest that TNT was found liable for. Now, he said that there's coextensive liability. The trial court agreed, and he doesn't contest that it's not full coextensive liability. The judgment amount that against TNT doesn't ipso facto equal the amount of EMC's liability. Why? Because it agreed with EMC, and they don't contest, it's not one of their points on appeal, that EMC can't be liable for attorney fees that TNT had agreed to pay. That's part of that earlier judgment, part for attorney fees. Judge Brown held in his judgment here in Greene County that we couldn't be liable for that, and he doesn't contest that. Judge Brown also agreed that, and the plaintiffs don't contest, that EMC wasn't statutorily liable for interest. Instead, the court held that the language of our bond was broad enough to contractually bind us to pay interest. But that's just legally not true. The only language the court pointed to in the bond was what the payment bond statute itself requires all bonds to have, to cover the contract between the principal and, in this case, Greene County, and for the owner to pay for equipment. Right? That's all payment bonds in the state of Missouri require that. But as this court held in the Austin case in 1921, that, which is in our brief as well, and he doesn't answer, that naked language doesn't automatically include interest. And the only cases he cites, including the Howard case, which I'll get to, that required a surety to pay interest a principal was found to owe, were either vexatious refusal cases, which this is not, where interest is statutorily required, or where a surety didn't contest having to pay non-penal interest. He had no non-vexatious refusal case like this, where a surety contested having to pay interest a principal owed, and a court held it was bound to. In the Howard case in 1991, he suggests in his reply brief that the court there called interest, quote, contract damages. It most certainly did not. It certainly referred to contract damages. If you look at page 564 of that decision, the contract damages are $52,000 sum in actual principal that the prior principal or subcontractor or whoever owed. And the interest is an additional $19,000 or so. But the reason interest was owed there was this was a vexatious refusal case where interest is part of the damages that the insurer who vexatiously refuses has to pay. Moreover, the quote, said contract in the bond language to which the trial court pointed plainly refers to D&E's contract with Greene County, not some subcontractor's contract with a supplier. There's no evidence that D&E's contract with Greene County required D&E to pay interest a subcontractor agreed to pay a supplier. Now, in his reply brief, he includes some discovery that's not in the record and suggests that this is our fault because we didn't provide a copy of that contract. This is a contract between Greene County and a public works contractor. Surely he could have gone over to the county courthouse and gotten a copy of that. It's his burden to show that we're liable for interest, not ours to show that we're not. So, in that end, we aren't liable for interest. We could only be liable for $18,873 in principal. And finally, if either plaintiff could sue for interest, then summary judgment was error because there's a genuine dispute of material fact. The law of Missouri is that a prior default judgment against the surety's principal or subcontractor is only prima facie evidence of the surety's debt. That can be rebutted by showing the judgment was the product of fraud or collusion. That's the Savage case in 1937, the Bell case in 2017, and his vaunted prior opinion in this case at footnote 7, quoting the fraud carve-out language from Savage. As these decisions recognize, as well as numerous others from other states we cite, fraud is a defense to a surety being held liable in a judgment against the principal. Well, viewing the record in the light most favorable to EMC, drawing all inferences in its favor, Four Star's default judgment against TNT was procured by fraud, just as the trial court already found in the earlier 2012 judgment. So look at page 73 and 74 of our brief, which echoes our suggestions in opposition to the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment below. That's document 36, pages 21 and 22. We go through every element of fraud and show how our material facts met them all, and the plaintiffs provide no counter to this at all in their reply brief. Viewing the record most favorably to EMC, Four Star did not deliver materials for the project under a contract with the subcontractor because TNT had been fired. The project manager himself testified, and we have his sworn testimony, that in fact, TNT had not been a subcontractor on this project during that time. This is fraud. Four Star's representations were false. It knew they were false. They were material, etc., all nine elements of fraud. So what the court should do is affirm the trial court's judgment against RGH, reverse the judgment for Four Star. Otherwise, it should modify the judgment to be for $18,873. If the court's willing to do that, we won't require going back for a trial. And otherwise, if the court holds that the plaintiffs could proceed, and we could, it should reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Please, the court.
Mr. Marsh.
I think one thing EMC is asking this court to forget is that EMC was a party and fully participated in the TNT case. That's established in the prior judgment. The prior judgment indicated that the same facts and same parties were involved in the TNT case. The TNT judgment's in favor of Four Star, indeed Four Star itself. That's noted in the opinion. EMC didn't challenge the Four Star versus TNT judgment in any way. It's too late to do that now. In fact, all these things, or at least most of these things that Jonathan's talked about here today, are barred by the doctrines of res judicata, collateral estoppel. I mean, EMC was fully involved in that TNT case. The so-called fraud carve-out that he's talking about, that is talked about in paragraph or footnote 7 of the opinion, that would apply where the surety had no knowledge of the lawsuit even going on. Here, the surety was involved in that lawsuit. So all these things, or at least most of these things that he's talked about here today, they're things that have been adjudicated already. EMC was involved in that case already. The judgment's been entered already, and we're kind of late in the game. Now, additionally, I pointed out in our brief that a lot of these defenses they didn't raise in their answer. They're required to raise this stuff in their answer. Capacity of a party, they didn't do it. Statute of limitations, they didn't. That's not in their answer. Those things have been waived. or admitted, as pointed out in our reply brief. So it's water under the bridge. I know that they would love to keep this thing going on and try to figure out some way to weasel out of it, but I think, you know, based on the law as established, based on the prior four-star opinion, based on the TNT judgment, it's a done deal. When this case was remanded back in 2014 or whenever it was, EMC was given the opportunity, if they challenged any particular issues or particular components of the damages in the TNT contract, they were given that opportunity. They didn't do that. The only thing they've challenged is some interest, and the attorney's fees. We're not appealing that because it's not worth appealing. But as far as whether the, I think it's footnote 11 maybe, in the prior opinion, they had the opportunity, if they wanted to challenge whether this was rental or repairs to equipment, they could have done that. Well, they didn't do that with in front of Judge Brown, so they didn't appeal that either. So, you know, we're for better or worse, we're stuck with the TNT judgment against EMC. So, with that being said, if there's no questions, I will give way. Appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. We'll be in recess for 5 minutes.